After a brief refuel in Tokyo, Rafael Enciso and Calvin James landed at Hokum Air Force Base in the Gulfstream 4. On arrival, they got out and were greeted by a colonel in Naval Intelligence who handed two gym bags to the Phoenix Force pair.
James Essen, I'll take you to the conference at Pearl Harbor Naval Station.
Pleased to meet you, Essen. I'm Ray. He's Farrell.
Of course you are. Mr. Brognola called to arrange these care packages. I hope that you like what I picked out for you.
Hey, if it works, I'll like it.
James walked over to a table and opened his bag.
Oop, got a call. Be right back. Ray here. Oh, hey, what's the news? Yeah, okay. Shit.
Inside James's bag was a black polymer pistol. It looked like his old Colt Commander 45 auto before Phoenix Force went strictly to 9mm pistols. James picked it up and checked the magazine. Witness holes showed 12 fat bullets. The top round displayed a cavernous hollow point.
USP-45 service pistols, courtesy of the teams.
James did a press check. No round was in the chamber, so he loaded the magazine and racked the slide. Still cocked, he thumbed up the safety. One reason why James liked the USP was that he could carry it locked and cocked like he had his old commander. These must have been pistols from the Navy SEAL's inventory. An ex-SEAL himself, James felt a small surge of warmth and pride at the gift. James slipped the locked and cocked 45 into its paddle holster and clipped it to his belt as Enciso walked up beside him and began to rummage through his own bag. In his own bag, James found a lightweight Black Hawk vest. He checked the magazine pouches and then found the machine pistol they fed. It was a Colt 9mm submachine gun, laid out just like his favorite M16 rifle, except for a smaller caliber. He glanced over to his partner.
Who called?
That was Barb. She let us know that Sear sent one of his men to Nairobi.
Oh, sure. They get to play with ninjas and ghouls.
They are sure that Cassandra is going to be involved in this, so we get a cyber witch.
We heard the preliminary reports. This ninja crap is for real?
Real enough to kill over a dozen CIA agents in Hong Kong.
Jesus.
Enciso strapped on his guns. He found a Walther PPK as a backup pistol.
I see Hal thought of everything.
A little 380 isn't my particular choice for shooting bad guys.
That's because it takes an expert to make the most of it.
James winked as he recovered some of his humor.
All right, let's show Sear how much of a mistake he made.
I honestly don't think that, ninja or not, he's going to come here. This is where the meeting is being held. There are enough Marines and SEALs on high alert right now.
With all due respect, Essen, Cassandra has murdered countless well-armed law enforcement agents and operatives over the past few months. She just turned Nairobi into a war zone and nearly killed 300 off-duty cops in San Francisco. Do you think she doesn't have a plan to make the last attack on Pearl Harbor look like a slap on the wrist?
You mean those nuts who attacked the celebration with the rocket torpedoes?
No, the first one.
Oh, I was afraid you were talking about that. Even so, we have F-18s and F-14s flying cover over the station at all times. Hokum is taking up the slack, too, with their jets.
As they stepped outside to the waiting limousine, the Phoenix Force pair turned to see two jet fighters blast off down the runway.
Is enough firepower in the air to sink a flotilla. Plus, we have phalanx anti-missile cannons, radar...
I wouldn't count on communications. She can scramble and hijack just about anything with her setup. She shut down Nairobi and San Francisco completely.
But we have mil-spec communications.
So do the Joint Task Force in Nairobi. That's why we're glad you gave us the arsenal.
Enciso sat down and opened his bag. He strapped a sheath knife to his ankle and another to his rippling forearm. He rolled down his pant leg and sleeve to cover them both. James did likewise.
I'm sorry to say this, but from what you're telling me, it seems like you guys are more like a band-aid on a shotgun wound.
Don't worry, I'm a better medic than that.
I certainly hope so.
Essen tried his best to make himself comfortable as they settled in for the ride to Pearl Harbor. Kara Duong, otherwise known as Cassandra, closed her laptop.
Farrow and Ray have just landed at Hokum.
Persistent bastards, aren't they?
Wilson Sear glared at Terramota, who sharpened her knife with a stone.
Too bad those killer elite couldn't take care of them.
If you want to beat, don't forget your ninjas also failed against them. Ninjas.
Take it easy, you two. We've done too much work to let an argument split us up at the last minute.
Seer and Terremoto both nodded numbly.
Okay. Ray and Farrow are two members of the mystery group you encountered while training with Delta, Big Brother. We've graduated to the big time here. If half of what I've read about them is true, they have prevented the end of life as we know it on no less than 4 separate occasions.
The world nearly ended 4 times?
At least. Remember that week when all the satellite communications around the planet were knocked out?
Yeah, that really threw off our timetable against Mott.
They were in on that. They took out the creeps behind the blackout.
That wasn't the end of the world.
And when the president and the premier of the Soviet Union were kidnapped back at the end of the Cold War? If they hadn't rescued those two, World War III would have surely started. Then there was the theft of a case of deadly supernumonia.
Okay, I get the point.
I just need you to do your job and get away. Once we're done, you'll be able to disappear and live the good life.
And what about you?
Don't worry about me.
You're letting her throw her life away.
It's not throwing my life away. It's fulfilling my destiny. I should be able to get away if my plan goes off perfectly.
No plan goes off perfectly.
We got Mott here, didn't we? And there are plenty of corpses littering Nairobi that can implicate him in setting off an international tragedy.
If those mysterious computer guys who are guiding this team around aren't leveling the playing field...
Destroying the evidence trail I left? God damn it! This force is ruining everything! Oh well, if all else fails...
Duong stopped and looked at the TV in the hotel room. CNN had been playing footage of the incidents in Kenya and San Francisco non-stop. She reached over for the remote and turned up the television. Now Ridley Mott's face appeared on the screen.
For questioning in conjunction with weapon sales to the Shining Warrior Path. Mott is currently out of the public eye. He was scheduled to appear at the Law Enforcement Expo with the President, but the terrorist attack at the Moscone Center has put an end to those plans. Later today, there'll be...
Duong set down the remote.
It seems the mystery team's guardian angels have already cracked the encryption on those bank transactions. I was certain it would have held up longer to give me enough time. Shit!
If they put him in jail...
I've put in... contingencies. Let's go.
The trio left the hotel room.
This satellite phone's acting funky. Some kind of interference.
You think it could be Cassandra?
Could be.
Wait, we have communication from Pearl Harbor.
Selective blackouts? The signals Cassandra is using are causing static?
Enciso held up one finger.
There's no answer from Pearl Harbor security station in regards to Mott's arms sale. She's blocking any communication mentioning that.
How?
Probably using a variation on the carnivore program.
Doesn't that just handle email?
That's what most people think, but no. It intercepts phone messages and monitors broadcast frequencies too. It's got its code piggybacking off most of the communications mediums used today. But knowing Cassandra, she infiltrated the actual carnivore program and overrode some of the safety protocols. This way, she could selectively filter out anything she didn't want to get through to Pearl Harbor.
My God.
Told you she was big time.
Yeah, she wants Mott at Pearl Harbor.
So what do you suggest?
Shit, the phone's not working. We're cut off.
We're almost there. There's a gate.
2 towering radomes with multi-barrel Vulcan machine guns swiveled to life. James and Enciso looked on in horror as the radar-directed Phalanx anti-missile cannon swiveled toward them, their 20-millimeter muzzles whirled in preparation to unleash a torrent of fire that was designed to shred an enemy missile or fighter jet. Even an armored Navy limousine wouldn't stand a chance against the devastating weapons. Deputy Director Ridley Mott heard the alarms go off and tensed. His bodyguards bracketed him a little more tightly, their Sig Sauer P-229s in their fists.
Cassandra's here.
The building shook suddenly as if it were caught in the teeth of a giant dog. The other Coalition representatives, their own protectors, tensed against the assault, looked all around, trying to make sense of the situation. One of the bodyguards rushed to the window and looked out.
Get away from the window, you fool!
The Secret Service man's ragged corpse, sawn in two by the detonation of a 20-millimeter explosive shell, flew across the conference room like a grisly scarecrow tossed by a tornado. The assembled VIP protection personnel were trained to deal with assassins, but not with high-explosive anti-aircraft guns gone wild. Mott remembered the droning buzz of the Phalanx autocannons from several displays of their effectiveness at Broom Lake when they were first tested. The sound was unmistakable. Ceiling tiles crashed to the floor in the hallway. One of the lightweight fibers bounced off Mott's shoulder. He shoved it aside and ran broken field pattern down the corridor. The building still shook, and Mott realized what had happened. The Cyber Witch had taken control of the blisteringly powerful Phalanx systems and turned them against the very facility that they were supposed to protect. Mott jumped down a flight of stairs in time to avoid a wall's detonation under the onslaught of 20-millimeter anti-missile shells. Even the military-grade construction of the conference center wasn't sufficient to survive for long against the incessant hammering of those shells, ripped out at 6,000 RPM. The deputy director thought about the customized Colt 1911 on his hip, a weapon he kept on hand despite the need for bodyguards. As an ex-soldier, he was cognizant of the fact that he would have to fight for himself eventually. That meeting with the deadly Cara Duong on a San Francisco bridge years ago reminded him of that. This was that same old reliable auto pistol that the woman had attempted to murder him with. He kept it as a souvenir of a brush with sudden death, a reminder that even his bodyguards weren't infallible. He'd modified the gun over the years, added new grips and new sights, had the extractor tuned as it had weakened, and put in replacement springs and recoil buffers. It was his absolute favorite pistol, lovingly cared for, but shot often to keep his skills from deteriorating. Now, when he was prepared to finish that old conflict, the pistol was all but useless. The 45 was a magnificent man-stopper, but it couldn't knock out a gigantic armored anti-missile cannon half a mile away. Mott continued to the basement. There were access tunnels underneath the Pearl Harbor base. Mott knew that much. He'd studied the plans as part of his duty as the Pacific Rim Director of Homeland Security. They were bolt holes that enabled personnel to escape in the event of another air raid. The tunnels were even secure against a low-yield nuclear weapon. He reached the basement entrance and drew his 45. What if Cassandra was waiting for him down here? The Secret Service men would get him to shelter against such a thundering attack, which meant the armored tunnels would be his only refuge and first destination. He snicked off the old Colt's safety and pushed the door open. If she was down here, she would learn not to fuck with even an old soldier, Mott thought as he descended into the darkness. The Phalanx autocannons didn't open fire on the limousine, but continued to rotate and aim toward the heart of the base. As their muzzles crossed the gatehouse, they erupted, obliterating it and several feet of chain-link fence in a horrendous storm of explosive shells. The violent deaths of the Marine guards shook the men of Phoenix Force into action. Rafael Enciso was first out of the limo, gym bag in hand. Calvin James was hot on his heels.
How the hell are we gonna stop that?
We improvise!
Enciso pulled a grenade from his war bag and slung the shoulder straps across his back. He cut toward the left cannon while James turned toward the right one. The stocky Cuban ran through the wrecked gate and raced toward the cannon. The barrels whirled so quickly they looked like a single smooth cylinder. He could see the feed box of shells nestled under the curved armored hull of the radome. With a leap, he snagged the base of the cannon and clawed up, his grenade clenched tightly in his fist. It would take split-second timing, but he had no choice. He was the only one who could stop this mad assault. When he reached the cannon's mechanism, Enciso pulled the pin on his grenade. The safety spoon flew, and he jammed the cylinder of the fragger into the space between one of the massive feed boxes for the autocannon's ammunition and the chain drive for the Phalanx itself. He had to overextend himself and stretched all the way into the narrow gap, but once the bomb was in place, he pushed off violently from the side of the Phalanx. Halfway to the ground, Enciso curled up against the explosion. While the fragmentation grenade didn't have the power to wreck the cannon, it managed to throw off the feed mechanism. 20-millimeter shells tumbled clumsily toward the breech and plugged it up. The spinning breech snapped shut on one explosive tip milliseconds after the initial grenade blast, and the HE shell ripped apart and self-destructed in a powerful flash. It set off the surrounding cannon rounds in a chain-fire explosion. Jagged chunks of armor flew from the shattered radome, and the whirling barrels slammed into the asphalt in front of the Phalanx. Because they still spun through the air at 3,000 RPM, the barrels came apart in an explosive display of their own and shot out like gigantic black spears. Enciso looked up. The fall had knocked the wind out of him. He looked over and saw that the other anti-missile cannon that James had climbed onto was reduced to a similar heap of wreckage. James lay stunned behind his shattered tower, and Enciso jogged across to him. Other Phalanx cannons still ripped the air. Pearl Harbor spit up gouts of flame from where its own defense systems ripped into it. Enciso reached James' side.
There's a little hole under the drive chain. Was that what you used?
Nah, I put mine under the feed box. Let the ammo do the rest.
Good idea. Knock the hell out of them.
Yeah. Two down, too damn many to go. We try to take the limo across that field, we'll be ripped in two.
Well, we can try going under the field.
What? Access tunnels?
And raid shelters. When I was in the SEALs, my team used them for tunnel fighting exercises to get us used to claustrophobic conditions.
Who said they would be used as raid shelters?
In an emergency, just like this one.
That's how Cassandra's going to get mopped. The Phalanx cannons are just a distraction.
Jesus, H.
Back to the gate. There's an entrance there. I saw it blasted open when we passed through.
Enciso nodded, and the Phoenix Force duo drew their Colt SMGs and raced for the tunnels beneath Pearl Harbor. They could only hope that someone else was able to deal with the out-of-control anti-missile cannons.
Hal, we haven't been able to get through to them.
Another attack on Pearl Harbor. Cassandra knocked out communications?
Seems to be her standard operating procedure. It adds to the confusion and gives her a window of opportunity for her teams to take action unmolested.
Hasn't worked that well. San Francisco was taken care of handily.
Only because Able Team was already on the scene. Nairobi is still getting back under control hours after David reported that his team took care of Ajax and Al Ghul.
What about General Kumar? Will he be able to testify that he received funds from Mott's cutout companies?
Yes.
Shit. Just when the Department of Homeland Security was undergoing a budget crisis, Mott had the idea to secure his job. That's the best I could make of it. He gets the Shining Warrior path to stage a pan-national incident in Central Africa, and suddenly we have to increase our funding to keep an eye on Africa.
What's disturbing is that Mott has ties to the Republic of China. Enough influence to get them to launder his money and send weapons to Kumar on his behalf.
Kill the investigation.
What?
Kill the investigation. We're gonna clean this up in-house.
But we already put out the warrant.
We announced that he was supposed to be picked up for questioning only. If we drop it, then it'll fade out of the news. If he's in jail, then we can't touch him.
So we'll just allow Cassandra to kill Mott?
No, she has to be stopped too. Ideally, the two of them will kill each other, but if she misses, or if James and Enciso stop her, then it's our shot. Kurtzman?
Yeah?
Any word on how Cassandra's been controlling communications? People are gonna want to know how entire systems have been compromised.
Takedo, any word?
Yeah, I think so. But you're not gonna like it.
I never like anything I hear on this job. Out with it.
Well, it seems like there's been a lot more packets moving in and out of Washington, D.C. during the times communication has failed around the world. These things bounce all over the place. There are mirrors in China, England, Japan, India, and even...
What's the cause, Takedo?
She hit it well, but it seems like the jamming is coming from the J. Edgar Hoover building.
My God. Are you saying that somebody in the FBI is working with...
No. Absolutely not. It seems more like their own systems have been compromised without them knowing it. More specifically, Carnivore's been hacked. I'd be willing to bet money that if you were to call them and ask them to check their Carnivore systems, they'd find Cassandra's code.
I'll have them check it out. And if it's true, the FBI's IT department will unplug the system before it can do any more harm. And Takedo?
Yes, sir?
Good work. I owe you an iPod.
Thank you, sir.
Hal, I'm getting reports in that Pearl Harbor is under attack from its own Phalanx cannons.
Shit. Is there anything we can do to help?
With most communications shut down, I'd have to directly alert Nimitz to the situation. It would be breaking protocol, however.
The most important thing is the lives of our men and the men of this country.
I hear you loud and clear. I'll ask them to launch two F-17 fighters armed with Wild Weasel systems.
The Wild Weasel was the Navy and Air Force's nickname for radar-hunting air-to-surface missiles, designed specifically to knock out radar-directed anti-aircraft systems. The Wild Weasels were the pilots who put their lives on the line to clear the airspace of ground defenses in hostile enemy territory. Now, with Cassandra's control over the Phalanx weapon systems, They were needed to knock out the hijacked protective screen that shielded Pearl Harbor against hostile enemies.
Done. They're on their way. Also, two of the cannons were already taken out, according to satellite photography.
Phoenix Force?
Saving the day, as usual.
Let's hope the hell so.
With evidence that Mott had assisted a terrorist incident to further his career, and the attack on Pearl Harbor, Brugnola couldn't help but think that this was a new day of infamy. The two Phoenix Force warriors had left Essen to take command of the damaged gate at Pearl Harbor Naval Station. Keeping civilians and unsuspecting personnel out of the field of fire while the Phalanx anti-missile cannons wreaked havoc on the base was a priority, especially since the security force was pinned down by salvos of withering fire from the 20-millimeter Vulcans. Raphael Enciso and Calvin James agreed that if they split up, the odds of finding Ridley Mott, and by extension Cassandra, Seer, and Terremota, would be greater. Whether they ran into an entire force of Seer's ninja assassins in the tunnels was another question, but it was a risk the Stony Man operatives decided to take. As the Surefire light on his Colt 635 blazed into the shadows, Enciso felt a twinge of claustrophobia. The KAC quick mount suppressor was snapped onto the end of his machine pistol because the enclosed space would amplify the bellow of the muzzle blast loud enough to rupture an eardrum. Permanent hearing loss wasn't something that the stocky Cuban wanted to risk, especially in the middle of a battle. Even temporary deafness would leave him vulnerable to surprise attack. As it was, he had a pair of earplugs in. The soft foam plugs would dampen the roar of unsilenced weapons in the confined tunnels.
Don't shoot!
He aimed the light at a group of sailors in various states of dress. They held up their hands.
I'm with Homeland Security. Are you guys okay? Any wounded?
He turned off the light and waved them forward. Buzz cuts and dog tags marked them as Navy personnel. Sweat, grime, and the smell of fresh smoke on their clothes told him that they'd just escaped an inferno. One sailor in a shredded tank top took a cautious step forward. His body was smeared with oil, and blisters rose on the raw skin of his shoulders.
We left behind a couple men back in the motor pool, but I think they were dead.
It's okay, sailor. Get to the entrance. Emergency services should be at the gate shortly to take care of your burns.
We saw fighter jets approach before. They flew in low.
Probably off an aircraft carrier. Hickam is in airlift field with transport craft.
Yeah, I saw Nimitz markings on the tail boom of one as it climbed away. They blasted one of the phalanxes.
All right. The cavalry's here. Get to the surface and take care of those injuries. I'll look for more sailors.
Thanks.
The walking wounded squeezed past him in the tunnel and retreated into the darkness. Enciso knew that Stony Man Farm had to have been on the case. With communications bottled up over the base and probably over half the island, only the farm's equipment could have broken through to the Nimitz to send reinforcements. Hope and pride filled his chest. At least the naval station would be protected from further damage and mayhem. The Cuban jogged deeper into the dark tunnels, his gunlight on again. He turned a corner and spotted a group of men wearing grayish-green jumpsuits, similar to those the Navy SEALs wore. The Nomex one-piece outfits provided protection from the elements as well as freedom of motion and plenty of pockets for gear. But something stuck in Enciso's mind for a moment. He saw that although their boots were laced up, the loops of their knots hung loosely. There were several rules of thumb that went with SEALs, even while training. No insignias worn while in their jumpsuits was one. But all boot laces had to be tied tightly in knots, and the laces strapped down by 100-mile-an-hour tape, a dull camouflaged variation on duct tape used by the military. Boot laces were expendable and had to be secured tightly, lest they be blown off while the commandos jumped out of planes or snagged on underbrush and pipes while they walked through cluttered environments. That gave Enciso all the warning he needed to dive to the floor. The fake SEALs turned as one.
Damn! It's Ray! Get him!
Enciso rolled behind the corner of an intersection as rifle rounds spit into the floor. Concrete erupted in volcanic puffs of pebbles and dust. Though he'd only caught a glimpse of the woman who cried out, he recognized the wicked murderous Terremota. The Phoenix Force warrior plucked a stun shock grenade from his harness, popped the pin free, and bounced it off the far wall. Enciso rose from cover and swung his Colt around the corner. The fake SEALs were sprawled, stunned by the force of the mini-bomb. One of Seer's ninjas struggled to bring up the muzzle of his MP5, but Enciso fired first. A volley of 9mm rounds peppered the stunned gunman's chest and threw him off balance. The invaders wore body armor as well as helmets, so he aimed for his face. Another faux SEAL tugged at the Glock in his hip holster, but Enciso stepped up to him and swung the tubular steel stock of his submachine gun into the killer's throat. Blood burst from the man's lips as his windpipe was crushed by the force of the butt stroke. Enciso gave him a second hack with the hard end of his assault weapon and knocked him to the ground to choke to death. Another jumpsuited killer wrapped his arms around Enciso's head and neck, wrenching hard. The Cuban's neck muscles were too powerful for the sudden twist to do more than give him a painful stretch, but a forearm closed over his trachea. The fourth of the fake Navy commandos got shakily to his feet and stooped to pick up a fallen machine pistol. Enciso plunged his hand into his pocket and pulled out his Walther PPK. He shoved the muzzle into his grappling opponent's groin and pulled the trigger. The Phoenix Force veteran lurched forward and stomped his boot on the barrel of the other killer's weapon. Enciso's weight tore the weapon out of his hand, and he stabbed the hot muzzle of his Walther into the last man's face. At contact distance, it didn't matter what caliber the handgun was. It was a ruthless bit of butcher's work, but outnumbered as he was, Enciso couldn't afford to be merciful to his enemies. His castrated opponent clutched his shattered crotch as he tried to stamp down the gush of blood from a severed femoral artery. The Cuban leveled his PPK at the wounded man and pumped a single bullet through the poor guy's forehead. That just left Terremota. Enciso bent his knees deeply to maintain his support and awareness of his surroundings as he retrieved the Colt subgun. Enciso wrenched his head violently to the side. The hot flash of a muzzle blast burned his ear and cheek as Terremota's handgun went off. Only the fact that Enciso wore his plugs kept his eardrum from shattering as the handgun exploded at point-blank range. He snapped his arm up and around Terremota's wrist and yanked her over his shoulder. The two combatants spilled to the floor, but the Phoenix Force warrior managed to tear the pistol out of the Ajax demolitions expert's hand. Terremota bent sharply and kicked the Walther out of Enciso's grasp a heartbeat later. The Cuban reached for the Heckler & Koch pistol on his hip. But the woman swept her forearm across his ankles. Enciso collapsed to the floor, and the agile Terremota rolled to a three-point stance. The Phoenix Force warrior pushed off from the ground, both hands occupied with holding him up. Then he saw the glimmer of steel glint in his opponent's hand. Terremota lunged, and the point of her knife speared across Enciso's shoulder as he ducked under her attack. Had he not moved, she would have pierced him through the heart, regardless of his body armor. The Cuban hammered his elbow into Terremota's stomach and felt the resistance of her own vest blunt the force of his blow. With a powerful shrug, he dislodged her from across his back and pulled his own knife out of its forearm sheath. Though it wasn't the cold steel Tonto he favored, the Chris Reeves Shadow 4 that Essen had lent him was a well-balanced spearpoint blade. The Phoenix Force knife expert quickly flipped the weapon into an ice pick grip and blocked a savage slash from Terremota that raised sparks. Had he tried to draw his USP 45, she certainly would have sliced him from ear to ear. Despite her diminutive size, the lethal Argentinian assassin displayed as much power as Enciso himself. Though she was 4 inches shorter than he was, the Ontario RAT-7 knife she carried was 2 inches longer than Enciso's own Shadow 4. That and her nimble speed made up for her lack of reach. It would be a close fight, and in close knife fights, Enciso knew that injury was unavoidable. From the way that the woman's eyes glimmered in the darkness, as if filled with delight, he knew that she wasn't going to back down from this confrontation.
Oh, okay, you son of a bitch. You like to play with steel, too?
I don't like it. I'm just good at it.
He looked for an opening. The little killer circled away from him. She sized up his weaknesses as well. The two of them were evenly matched in skill, because every time Enciso tensed to take advantage of an opening, the Ajax assassin adjusted her stance to protect that weak spot.
Good. Is it good enough?
Modesty keeps me from saying more.
He dropped back into a defensive stance as Terremota fainted and reacted to another slash. While the Chris Reeve blade blunted the Ontario's cut, she still opened a 3-inch gash in his forearm. Enciso kicked at her feet, but recoiled as she chopped down and nearly carved a chunk out of his thigh. He whipped over her low cut and connected with the pommel of his knife, snapping her head around. Enciso stepped in for the kill, but Terremota kicked with all the power in her legs. For a brief moment, the Cuban wondered where she'd gotten the sledgehammer from, but he spun out of the way of her follow-up lunge. His own knee pistoned into Terremota's jaw and knocked her away from him. In frustration, the lethal Argentinian sliced at his stomach, but the wicked point of the knife only cut the outermost layers of Enciso's load-bearing vest. A pocket that held magazines for his Colt submachine gun split open and spilled its contents on the floor. The Cuban commando kicked one of the clips and it bounced into Terremota's knee. She sidestepped reflexively and gave Enciso an opening. The Ajax assassin snapped her foot hard into Enciso's side, but the brawny little Cuban closed his arm over her ankle. With a savage twist, he yanked her off balance and hammered her into the wall. Terremoto's knee cracked as she stopped against the hard concrete, but Enciso kept going. Filled with rage and pain, she plunged her knife into the Cuban's shoulder. The point had struck the protective bone of his scapula at an angle, and she only split skin instead of spearing a vital organ. Already, his right arm lost strength as she nicked the muscles that anchored his shoulder to his back. In return, he brought the Shadow Four's point around in a vicious stab, and the point of his knife pierced her protective vest and slipped between her ribs. Blood frothed in the Argentinian knife fighter's nose and mouth. Her eyes turned glassy. Absently, Enciso realized he'd severed a pleural or bronchial artery. He twisted the 5.5-inch blade with all his might and whipped its razor-sharp edge through the center of her ribcage. Terremoto slumped to the ground, and Enciso collapsed to his knees. Blood soaked his back, and his arm hung almost useless at his side. The Phoenix Force warrior leaned against the wall and breathed deeply to gather his strength. If he couldn't get to his feet, it would be all up to Calvin James. Calvin James turned the corner and literally ran into Ridley Mott.
Motherfucker! Die! Die, you fucker!
I'm on your side.
Well, you have a funny way of showing it. Who taught you to punch?
Who taught you to shoot?
Ha fucking ha.
Put the gun away before you actually hit something.
Fuck you. I'm not gonna make myself an easy target.
You're Ridley Mott?
You know Rosario Blancanales and his nerd buddy Schwartz?
James avoided the question, even though his dark eyes flashed with momentary anger.
I'm Calvin Farrow. I'm here to intercept Cassandra and her people before they kill you.
You must know them. They teach you how to threaten government officials where you come from?
James angrily wrapped his long fingers around the deputy director's throat.
How about you act like a human being for about 15 minutes and let me save your life? You think you can do that, or are you gonna make me do the terrorists a fucking favor for once?
Okay, let go.
According to what I know, you're the bastard responsible for all these servicemen, feds, and cops being murdered. You give me lip, I'll gladly remember the piece of shit you are and kick your ass so hard you'll have to unbutton your collar to shit. Got that?
Yes.
James heard the scuff of feet behind him and swung around. A quintet of men, dressed in Navy SEAL Nomex flight suits, rushed down the hall. The hairs on his neck stood up. They didn't move in step or in the traditional SEAL conga line formation, standard operating procedure for a SEAL fire team in the confines of a tunnel. He brought his Colt 635 around and held down the trigger.
What the hell are you doing? Those are SEALs!
The deputy director pried the subgun out of the blindsided Phoenix Force warrior's hands. James hurled himself into the path of a burst of gunfire intended for Mott. He instinctively took a salvo of 9mm slugs in his body armor. He drove the both of them around the corner of the intersection, behind the protective cover of a concrete and pipe wall.
They're not fucking SEALs!
Oh, God.
Give me my gun!
His chest hurt from the burst, but Mott tore away from him and escaped down the side tunnel he'd burst out of, with James's gun.
Note to self, fuck Mott. Fuck him, fuck him, fuck him!
He drew his USP-45 and snicked off the safety. Autofire hammered against the corner and chips of stone and broken pipe erupted into the air. Hot jets of steam vented from one broken conduit. It gave James some cover as the enemy gunmen stopped their attack. He swung around the Heckler and Koch and aimed at head level. Sears ninjas were reported to wear body armor in Africa, and since he didn't have a nice armor-piercing weapon like an AK-47 or an FN-P90, he'd have to go with the tried-and-true failure-to-stop drill. Since he was sure his initial burst with the Colt subgun counted as two to the torso, he went for headshots. One steam-obscured gunman had collapsed, and another had staggered sideways as he clutched the bloodied remnants of his face. Back behind cover, James gulped down a breath of humid air and dropped to one knee, pivoting again. This time, he aimed at groin level and ripped off six more of the remaining 9 rounds in the USP. Another Ajax assassin collapsed to the floor, his weapon discarded as he clutched at ragged thighs. James saw the fourth ninja imposter slide down a group of pipes, face drawn tightly as a .45 caliber slug had crushed his hip to splinters. A submachine gun chattered in the darkness, but the Phoenix Force medic ducked out of the way. He tallied the odds. One dead, three seriously wounded on the enemy side. He ejected the partially spent magazine and fed his USP another 12-rounder, but he was planning to put an end to this now. He reached into his harness and pulled off a fragmentation grenade. No more Mr. Nice Guy, James thought, and hurled the bomb around the corner. As he did, another egg-shaped object bounced into view. The ex-SEAL didn't even waste the energy to look surprised. His lean, powerful frame sprung erect and launched down the hall. Their shockwaves combined to hammer James's brain as he crashed into the far wall. The back of his armored vest scratched him, and blood poured from several shallow cuts along his thighs. He avoided most of the shrapnel, but as he stood up, his boot soles crunched and scratched the concrete floor. He made a mental note to never complain about heavy combat boots again. Seer appeared from around the corner, tall, white-haired, with a goatee, one eye bloody and raw from a blast of steam. He was battered and shaken, but still an impressive sight.
You've got to be Seer.
That's right. And the last thing you'll ever see is your killing stroke.
James brought up the USP and fired, but the man dove to the floor and slid into the Phoenix Force warrior's shins. James tumbled over, but held on to his HK pistol. He pulled the trigger, but only caught Seer in his Kevlar vest. A powerful hand grabbed the ex-SEAL's right wrist and twisted his aim up the hall. The Ninja Master's other fist crashed against the point of James's jaw and bounced his head off the concrete floor. With a desperate twist, the slender, stony man commando threw Seer off balance. James snapped the heel of his left palm up into the white, bearded chin and rocked back the half-blind Ajax assassin's head. Seer hopped forward on his knees and landed his butt firmly on James's chest to drive the wind out of him. The Phoenix Force medic countered by wrapping his long stovepipe legs around the Ninja Master's neck. With every ounce of strength and leverage, he yanked Seer backward and cracked his skull against the pipe behind him. James stabbed the HK to full arm's length, but Seer had bumped his forearm against the pistol at the last moment. The .45 caliber slug missed his face by inches. The Ajax assassin followed up with an axe kick that chopped down onto James's clavicle. Searing pain knifed through the ex-SEAL's body, and he knew that his collarbone had been fractured by the force of the blow. The numbed fingers of his right hand released the USP. Seer chopped down with his heel again, but James was expecting it and leaned left, wrapping his arm around the killer's leg. James countered with a kick of his own into the Ninja Master's face. James twisted and rolled over onto the Ajax murderer's leg. He threw all his weight into overextending Seer's knee. James hooked his heel hard into Seer's breastbone and knocked the air out of him. The injured Phoenix Force warrior stomped hard against Seer's chin again and twisted it away from the murderer's throat. Desperate fingers clawed at James's calf as his boot pressed tightly over his adversary's throat. Seer beat frantically at the strangling foot. James twisted his entire body, still holding Seer's broken leg tightly. The Ajax assassin's mouth gaped widely in a futile effort to suck in oxygen. But it was no good. James's grip on the Ninja Master's broken limb provided him too much leverage, and his long, slender leg ground deeper and deeper into Seer's trachea. The pinned Ninja Master flopped wildly as oxygen deprivation dispelled his wits. Instead of fighting like a trained killer, he thrashed like a trapped animal. It took a minute and a half for Seer to stop struggling. With a monumental act of willpower, James urged his injured right arm to reach into his pocket for the Walther PPK. He pulled out the diminutive 380 and leveled it at Seer's good eye.
Just in case you're playing possum.
Suddenly, Seer jerked to life. The Phoenix Force veteran crawled off Seer's broken leg and put the Walther on safe. He took one look at Seer's ruined head, with a hole going straight through to the back. He stuffed the PPK back in his pocket and picked up the USP-45, transferring the lightweight HK to his left hand.
They say it was Neptune's Trident that destroyed Ajax for his crime against Cassandra, and the SEALs are the Navy's Trident. You didn't know how to dress like a SEAL, and it was one of us who put you down.
Enciso staggered into view.
Cal?
Rafe?
My back's cut up really bad. Could you take a look at... Shit! Shit!
Bone-weary and on wobbly knees, the Phoenix Force duo hobbled toward the sound of battle. Ajax and Cassandra weren't quite through yet. While Ridley Mott wasn't the expert that James or Enciso was when it came to recognizing real seals in the field, he didn't need many clues to figure out that two of them wouldn't run around the tunnels with someone in naval dress whites. As he swept them with the light from his subgun, he half-recognized the Asian woman with them. A decade and a half, and an absence of bloody, raw bruises on her face might have changed her a little, but it was that stupid bitch who'd tried to kill him. Those punks who beat up his security were right that Cassandra was the same woman who lured him into a trap with blackmail. The three of them reacted to the sudden bright light, but it was too late for them. He stitched them all at head level. The woman fell first, but the other two fake seals remained standing and shot back. Mott dived into a side tunnel.
Stupid damn Europellet piss-ass 9mm!
He threw the machine pistol to the ground and hauled out his Colt 45. The two Ajax ninja assassins advanced, their weapons lowered. They didn't expect the deputy director to be that well armed. The enraged deputy director whipped around the corner, shocking both men with his bravado. One gunman collapsed instantly, but the other stood, pole-axed, as his Kevlar helmet ripped off at the chin strap and toppled to the concrete. Finally, whatever kept the fake seal upright gave out, and he flopped to the ground, a lifeless sack of flesh.
You know, I'm gonna suggest to my golf buddy, the president, that we dump the goddamn Europellet and go back to real fucking handguns.
He glanced up and saw Cassandra crawl toward him. Mott chuckled and walked over to the wounded hacker. The left side of her face was coated in blood that poured from a furrow in her forehead.
Oh, hey. That's more like I remember you, bitch. Feel like a little fucky-fucky for old time's sake? Or should I just blow your goddamn head off?
Kara Duong glared at him with her right eye, the other stuck shut with sticky gore. Mott tried to stave off the uneasy chill that rolled down his spine. If looks could kill, he was certain he'd be cold meat by now.
Oh well, do you at least have any last words for me?
Countered by silence, Mott simply leveled the 45 at her forehead. Then he squinted. He saw a glint of light from something black and metallic under the hacker. It looked like... The contact range shotgun blast tore off Mott's leg at the knee. Mott stared at his naked shin bones, gleaming with blood in the surefire's glare. Kara Duong struggled to her knees.
Nope. No last words for you.
She looked at the Colt 45 that lay on the ground and squinted. She picked it up and read, scratched into the front strap of the grip, S2CW, with a heart symbol.
Sonny to Kara, with love. This is my brother's Colt 45. You kept it all this time?
Fuck you! You blew my damn leg off!
Duong looked around and made sure no bodyguards waited in the wings. Teeth broke out of Mott's mouth and fell from his shredded lips.
I've been waiting 15 years for that. Your mistake with me was that you threw me off a bridge and expected me to drown.
Drop it, Cassandra!
Duong turned and looked up to see the battered figures of Rafael Enciso and Calvin James limp into view. The muzzles of two USPs stared at her like black, unblinking eyes.
It's over. Drop your weapon.
Duong lowered the 45 from Mott's face.
I suppose my brother and Teramota are dead.
Your brother?
Wilson Seer. I'm his adopted sister, Kara Duong Seer.
Yeah, they're dead. Everyone in your crew is dead. All you have to do is give up.
Sonny to Kara. With love.
What?
You must be the mystery force. Or at least the ones who didn't go to Africa. Wonder why they didn't send you there.
Nobody else on the team spoke Japanese or Chinese.
All right. Good point. You know, Mott arranged for General Kumar and the Shining Warrior Path to kill American, British, and Canadian tourists just to give the Department of Homeland Security a reason to increase its spending, right?
Yeah. But our justice system will take care of that. It's all the other people you've had slaughtered that we're concerned about.
Just drop the gun. It doesn't have to end like this. With your testimony, you might even be able to bargain down to 99 life sentences instead of a death penalty.
Duong looked to them and smiled. Tears formed in her eyes.
Everyone I really loved or even liked is dead. I can't blame you, though. You were protecting yourselves and the people you're supposed to. I only did what I must for the only thing I could live for. Revenge.
James momentarily took his eyes off Duong to see Enciso wincing at the pain in his shoulder. When he looked back, it was too late. Don't do it!
Put it down! Just put it down!
Sorry.
Don't!
Duong brought up the muzzle and aimed it at the agonized Enciso. The USP-45 slug crashed into her forehead. The Prophetess of Doom dropped to her knees and then hit the floor. James stared in her eyes. Kara, Cassandra, the Prophetess of Doom, looked content. Her glassy eyes seemed like they were staring at James. He put his hand over her eyes, closing them forever.
What a waste.
James hooked his good arm under Enciso's uninjured shoulder, and together, the two warriors limped out of the death-reeking tunnels under Pearl Harbor, tired, battered, and trying to find comfort in the knowledge that they'd helped save hundreds of fellow lawmen. It was almost enough. Stony Man Doom Prophecy is a graphic audio production. Stony Man, The Executioner, and Mac Bolan are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2006, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Acel Ford, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, Casey Jones, Dolores King-Williams, Karen Carbone, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Acel Ford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Johann Detweiler. Graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry and Johann Detweiler. Adapted for graphic audio by Dan Smith. The Stony Man theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, and Dan Smith. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another graphic audio title.
The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
For the legendary mountain man preacher, times are lean. Trapping is a thing of the past. Only a handful of men cling to the old ways, trading pelts to a market with little demand. Thus it is that Preacher, along with his old friends Three Sleeps Norris and Antoine Revier, grudgingly accepts a commission from the War Department to act as trail guide and scout for a regiment of dragoons.
You're a scruffy-looking lot, I must say. Do you ever take baths? You'll have to in this army.
Pardon me, Colonel, but we ain't in this army. We're just hired to guide you to where you want to go in the Big Empty.
Yes. Well, from now on, until the completion of your employment, you will all refrain from spirits, liquor of any sort, and you will clean up your clothing and present a well-washed appearance at all times.
Now, whoa up there, second, Colonel. Exactly who are to be the guides for this expedition?
Why, you three, of course.
Well then, don't the Colonel think that the men in charge should have some say in how the soldier boys will march?
Regulations cover that quite nicely, I believe.
Ain't no regulation out there in the high lonesome.
Preacher's words will ring prophetically true, for in the Wyoming wild, Blackfoot, Sioux, Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Kiowa warriors have joined forces to prepare for battle, their bloodlust stirred by a legendary Blackfoot Messiah.
The day is coming soon when the white man will fall to the earth like rain in the spring.
When you have finished the ritual of Iron Shirt, you will be stronger than any bullet.
You say the white man's bullets cannot harm you, Iron Shirt. Prove it, and we will follow you.
I ask Bentrees to step to the far side of the fire. Take your gun in hand and point it at my chest. When I say so, shoot me. Now, Bentrees. You will be shown the secret of this medicine when you complete the ritual to become part of my Iron Shield Strongheart Society. Death to all White Eyes!
With the spirited Dragoon Squadron for cover, Preacher will forge up the blood-drenched Santa Fe Trail. But the only way to win this war is to stop the hell-raising Messiah, whose godforsaken message is leading to the ultimate showdown, the battle for Fort Washington.
Get my cannon moving! Fire!
Shoot them all!
Don't miss this epic tale of frontier battle. The first Mountain Man 7, Blackfoot Messiah.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.